Let's do it.
Well, hello out there in podcast land, and welcome back to Guilty Pleasures, the show where we celebrate the movies we love despite what critics, public opinion, or even our own God-given sense might tell us. I'm your host, Lou Hare, for the Front Row Network, and welcome to our second November episode. And I've been excited to do this movie. We've been talking about it for a long time, and we're finally going to do it. This year marks the 30th anniversary of a real peak in American cinema. So I'm very excited to be talking about 1989's Tango and Cash. And joining me on the panel tonight, one of the reasons we're doing this, somebody who is very excited about this movie, so I had to make sure we got it in because she wouldn't forgive me because she is my lovely wife, Miss Donna Hare. How's it going, Donna?
It's going well. Thank you. I'm
glad to have you with us. And joining us, we have two newcomers to the Front Row Network. So I'm very happy to have them on to discuss this movie and get all their thoughts. First off, I'd like to welcome Mr. Nick Benson. How's it going, Nick?
Good. Yeah.
All right.
Glad to be here.
Good. Well, thanks for coming on. And as per tradition with the Front Row Network, I'd like to want you to tell us all, what is your favorite movie?
My go-to answer is usually Jaws, but I feel like I want to mix it up. And I've been recently watching Kevin Smith movies, and I really like Mallrats. I had a Mallrats poster above my bed when I was a kid, and I think it's still in my childhood bedroom. And I like that movie. I'm not gonna say, yeah. So that's my choice today.
Cool. All right. Well, great to have you on. And also rounding out the panel, another newcomer to the Front Row. Please welcome Katrina Alder. How's it going, Katrina?
Pretty good. Thanks so much for having me. Oh, wait.
And as same question to you as I asked Nick, what is your favorite movie?
Oh, man, this is really difficult thinking about this. I have sort of a rotating top five. The first three usually stay the same, but then bottom two, it varies. Mm-hmm. And my go-to is typically any of the original, well, the Jackson Lord of the Rings trilogy, because I think those are all spectacular. But like Nick, since I'm in the middle of like thinking about different movies for, you know, teaching and all that, I'm probably going to say right now I'm really vibing again with Transformers, which is really one of my top five of all time. And right now it's kind of sitting at the top because I just kind of rewatched some parts of it recently and I was like, this is still really knocking my socks off. So I'm going to go with that one.
Excellent. All right. Well, let's get into it. Tonight's movie, Tango and Cash, released in 1989. Quick plot summary. When LA's two top cops are framed for a crime they didn't commit, they must overcome their personal differences to take down the mastermind behind it. It stars Sylvester Stallone and Kurt Russell as the aforementioned Tango and Cash. Playing the villain is Jack Palance, and playing the role of Sylvester Stallone's sister is a young Terry Hatcher, a couple years before she would blow up. So it's one of her earlier roles, but it's directed by Andre Konchalovsky, who is a name you're probably not familiar with because he's primarily a director of Russian films. And occasionally some TV, but there's some really interesting stories about the behind the scenes of this. So he is the credited director, is what I will say, because there is some fun drama behind the scenes of this movie that I'm very excited to get into.
I was going to say, are you going to reveal these?
Oh, 100%. But we'll dole it out as we go along. You know, we'll reveal a little bit more. But he gets credited with the directing of it. The writer, much like there were multiple directors, there were multiple writers on this film as well. But the ultimate credit goes to Randy Feldman. And so why are we talking about it on Guilty Pleasures? Well, this movie, first of all, this is my favorite stat about this movie because I think it sums up this movie perfectly. This movie was released Christmas weekend of 1989. It is technically the last film of the 80s.
Wow.
It is the last major release of the decade. And somehow that's perfect for this movie.
That explains a lot about the movie. It had big shoes to fill.
It did. It was like, okay, we gotta close this decade out with a bang. So here we go.
Let's give you 1,200 of them.
Yes. Yeah. But maybe Christmas weekend isn't the best time to release your 80s action movie because it doesn't do terribly well. It makes $63 million on a $55 million budget. So it's marginally profitable, not as much because it goes $20 million over budget, which we'll get to a little bit later. It's not well received by critics. It's got a current Rotten Tomatoes score of 31%. With a 52% audience score and a 6.4 on IMDb, which is exactly what the last movie, one of the movies I did last month was Silver Bullet. So apparently audiences like Gary Busey and Werewolves as much as they like the team of Kurt Russell and Sylvester Stallone.
That's an injustice.
Okay. So I guess Donna, you've been chomping at the bit to talk about this movie for a while. So I'm going to let you start. First impressions of Tango and Cash.
It's probably not even me watching it, but probably listening to my mother watch it. Cause as it was an R-rated movie, I would not have been allowed in the room to see it. So I'm sure it was like a bedtime, put the kids to bed, parents watching it on the old VCR. And I'm hearing my mother hoot and cackle. Like, she loves things to like blow up and Kurt Russell. She loves Kurt Russell. So just my first impressions are, I'm assuming my mother's enjoyment of watching that movie. Okay. Probably only the one time that she watched it. And then I think we may have caught it early on in our marriage on TV.
Okay.
And I don't know if I'd ever seen the beginning before we watched it on Monday. Yeah. So there's like a great love for this movie, but it's like, I don't have that much connection to the movie. So I think I love that I love the movie and not necessarily anything about the movie.
You love the idea.
I love the idea of the movie.
Of Tango and Cash.
You just like that it exists in the world. It
exactly.
Makes you feel better to know that something like that is out there.
Exactly. It makes us all better humans, right?
Sure. I mean, who better to unite a divided nation than Tango and Cash.
Right. Oh gosh.
It's about coming together.
I mean, if they can come together, we all can.
Yes. They can overcome all of the many, many differences between them. They were so different. Very
he wears glasses, he likes pizza. How are they ever gonna get along?
Yeah.
Isn't he like uptown or Beverly Hills and he's downtown LA?
Yeah. Yeah. How would these two guys ever, you know, how could they coexist?
That's right. These are big questions.
Well, I'm excited to tackle them. So now, Katrina, had you seen this film prior to the podcast?
No, and I thought I had until I went to go look it up, and I was like, oh, I would know if I saw this. It sounded familiar. I feel like people reference it, you know, offhand. And like there were clips in there and I was like, okay, are they part of just the way people shoot these scenes or is it because this was in Tango and Cash, people do this, you know? So anyway, so no, I had no real frame of reference for it.
All right. So given that, what was your first reaction to Tango and Cash?
So my first reaction was like, wait, have I not seen this before? Because I live for a really big, kind of out there explosive set of like action, but then the story was equally big and explosive and out there. And so I think I had a good time watching it, but I also had a lot of questions. Okay. about the movie and then like about the production, about, you know, just a lot. And of course I really wish I could have known how it was received back in the day, aside from, like you said, I looked online and I saw some things. I was like, I got to find a film review of this, you know, to get a better sense of it. But I'm with Donna. It needs to exist. I think that it's very important that this kind of buddy cop movie is out there. And that's the other thing that popped in my head. I was like, so 80s, because the buddy cop, you know, that was like the window. And I was like, I'm getting Beverly Hills Cop. I'm getting 48 Hours. I'm getting a little Rush Hour. I mean, I had so much happening because there's a lot happening. So
there's a lot happening. I can't wait to, we're going to dive all into this. Nick, how about you? What were your first impressions of Tango and Cash?
So I'm a big Stallone fan, but I'm also a very selective Stallone fan. Like, there's big gaps in my Stallone film knowledge, and this was one of them. And I think it's like I avoid a time period where I kind of know what he was trying to do, and I just stay away from it.
You don't look behind the curtain.
Right. And I have an idea of what those movies will be like. And this was one that I had always, I'd seen the poster a lot. Like, I kind of knew vaguely what it was. But I never knew if it was a serious movie or if it was more like Rhinestone and like Oscar, like, you know what I mean? I didn't know like what tone it was. And I can say after watching it, I still don't really know what it's supposed to be. So yeah, I had never seen it, and it was an interesting first. It kind of opened up the door to me going, maybe I should watch all of these Stallone movies that I'm missing.
I 100% endorse that plan.
Okay.
Now that you're older and wiser, yeah, right?
Yeah. No,
it opens you up more to Stallone.
it really does. No. So for me, this was an HBO staple. I don't know how many times I saw this. I don't know how many times I saw this movie in sequential order. It really doesn't matter. But I mean, this movie showed up on HBO and was just in heavy rotation in the early, this came out late 89. So this is like early 90s. This was like just almost like on the hour, like, you know, HBO or Showtime was showing this movie. So I saw this a lot more than I should have seen at that age. But but I just remember thinking, I was at the right age where this is not a serious action movie. This is, in a lot of ways, it's a little bit of a departure for Stallone and his action genre, because this is after Rambo 3. This is the year after Rambo 3. He'd done Cobra. He'd done a lot of like those, the heavier action movies. And this was like his attempt at like a action comedy. And so I remember enjoying that for like the quips and the one-liners. And then as, you know, as I've watched it through the years, I mean, I've now come to realize a lot, like what you said, Katrina, is like, there is so like, this is an 80s highlight reel because it just borrows liberally from every other action movie of the 80s. And as I started watching, you know, more 80s action movies, I was like, and then I would go back and watch Tango Cash. I was like, oh yeah. Oh, that's where they got all that from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so they used all the other movies as a menu and were like, let's order this up, order this up. Oh, yeah, we got to have this.
Yep, I want the mismatched partners. I want the, and can I get that with the side of
24-hour
deadline? can I get a little prison sequence too? Can I get that? Maybe it's an appetizer.
Yeah. Oh, you needed that. A rooftop. You needed your rooftop shots. You're dangling. Yeah.
Some rain.
Yep. Yep.
You must have a lot of weather.
A lot of weather.
You said the filmmaker was Russian, right?
Yes.
Well, so like it kind of like makes sense. It's almost like someone described to somebody what an American 80s action movie was, like briefly, and they went, all right, I think I get it. And then they just wrote a script and shot a movie, like they just like pieced together from somebody else's rendition of what that was. It was, yeah.
No, you know, you're not far off. Although the interesting thing is, he is fired midway through the movie because apparently he's the one who was lobbying for a more serious tone of the film. But ultimately, he clashed with the producer John Peters, who's a famous 80s producer. You know, produces the Lethal Weapon movies, produces Batman. He's like a, you know, major studio guy. And ultimately, the go-between between the two of them, oddly enough, was Stallone himself. And eventually, even Stallone couldn't broker that peace. Yeah.
And he broke communism in Rocky IV. Like, he couldn't tear down those walls.
Yeah, he could not. So ultimately, Konchalovsky is fired and replaced by Albert Magnoli. But I guess, you know, in Directors Guild, whatever, you know, he gets credit because he did most of the photography. But apparently, they then had to do a whole bunch of reshoots on the film because the tone was so off and was kind of this mishmash. And ultimately, I think the guy who really gets the credit for this movie, and again, this is going to make a lot of sense to some of the stuff we're saying, it was ultimately, I think the person who deserves all the credit for this movie being intelligible at all is Stuart Baird. He is a very famous editor. He directs a couple of action movies in the 90s, but his credits in editing are Lethal Weapons 1 and 2, Die Hard 2, The Last Boy Scout, Demolition Man. So he's got a lot of like major cred in the action genre. So he's basically the one who is able to land this plane because it had gone wildly off the rails. It went, like Ed mentioned earlier, $20 million over budget. And so, you know, all of that stuff is like, well, that's another reason I think that it looks so familiar. So let's get into it. So Katrina, you mentioned you had a lot of questions about the movie. So let's just start there. What's the biggest burning question that you have about Tango and Cash? And maybe we can walk through it.
I would probably say my biggest question was how these two characters were sort of pushed together by this shadowy figure, right? That they didn't have any idea they were both bringing down, right? Collectively. Mm-hmm. And then they just have all of these, I don't even know what the word, they don't like each other, like immediately. And so I was never really clear if they had ever met or not. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. was there a reason? Like you mentioned Lethal Weapon, like we got a sense what happened with, you know, how they're, because one of them was so different than the other. But so that was my biggest question was like, did they know each other ahead of this? Or was that night they both got set up? Was that their initial, do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Cause they talked about each other in their newspaper articles, but I never got a sense that they knew each other. So that's probably my biggest question.
I feel like this has been a long rivalry between them when they were growing up on the force and they had to like watch each other at award ceremonies, mm-hmm. like who got the best, mm-hmm. like, I don't know, fill in the blank award.
Right.
And they would start the quipping there, and mm-hmm. then it progressed to the newspapers as their careers advanced.
So you want,
it's
you want
deep seated.
So you want like Tango and Cash, the college years.
That would answer, that would help me so, cause like, I mean, my other question was, I wonder what inspired this. Cause like you said, it was a lot. Like I got Die Hard. I got like when they were on the roof with the villain, I was like, why am I getting Die Hard from this scene? When they were quipping back and forth, a reel of buddy cop movies kind of popped into my head. Mm-hmm. But what I didn't get was like, you know, with Rush Hour, we see how they met. We see why they immediately clashed. But then we get a sense of how they ended up working together. But throughout the film, I was like, they're going to go to prison together. They're going to, you know, so all of these things they're doing, and even in court. And I wonder if it goes back to that editing thing. Was there a strategy to use the newspaper to keep the story going because they had to, you know what I mean? Like, I wonder how much of the final product that I have questions about has to do with editing and sort of decisions that had to be made, and how much was this is how we want to advance the story or the narrative, you know? So I, you see my questions are like, I don't know, you know?
Yeah, I think it's just mostly the best answer the movie gives is just like professional jealousy. Like they're both mad that the other one is such a good cop, which
seems outshining them.
Right. That it's like, I want to capture all the drugs. No, I want it. But they're not even like in the same part of town.
They're really not.
Like they're not competing. Like they're not like, they're like, oh, you busted that guy when I wanted. No, you're like in like Los Angeles is a very large city. And there is plenty of crime to go around for those two cops. So it's not like this town's not big enough for the two of us. It's actually kind of is.
And I like how unaware they are that each other are working on the same case.
So right.
It's
right.
Like with as much attention that they spend watching newspapers and drug busts and like, can't they connect the lines that this is the same mastermind drug dealer that's providing the drugs for uptown, downtown?
Well, didn't one of them say like $1 billion and the other one was like 200 pounds or something, like these really large... Mm-hmm. Like you said,
they
like,
got all the drugs.
All right. I'm like, is there really that many people moving that much weight, like in this movie? Yeah.
I'm trying to remember, when is the first time we actually see them interact?
I think it was when they met up that night, right?
It's when they meet up at the bust that
and they quip
and they quip with each other
with guns
like pointed at each other. You know,
that's how they got so much. First time we see them at all. together? I thought that, but then I was like, that can't be. I must have forgotten.
See what I'm saying? That's how I was like, because when they blinked up, they start talking to each other like they knew each other.
Right.
I was like, I thought y'all didn't, I was, what's happening? And then
it's from the early days.
It's from those early days. In the academy. So
that's a lot to put on one scene, because you're setting up that these two cops are being framed. That that frame is actually working really well for some reason. I don't know why. It didn't seem careful.
They're being recorded. So their quips are now
with evidence
that they know each other and that they don't like each other. All of this is getting set up in one quick 3-minute scene.
That is very efficient screenwriting. All they do is see each other in the paper. They give one line, like they like each have like a smirk.
Isn't it at least 20 minutes into the movie too before they actually meet each other?
Probably.
Like, it's a good long while
around that.
Yeah, I mean, well, you got to build to that.
I mean, I definitely got a sense of who they were individually, so I think they did a nice job of laying out sort of the characterizations very early. I mean, we spent a bit of time with Stallone before we even got to Russell. So I was like, okay, so is he maybe the headliner? You know what I mean? Like so then it switched over and then I was like, okay, but we never got that here's the two of them and here's how we know why they yada, yada, yada. Wasn't it so the bit, like you said, that's a lot on a scene. You're right. I hadn't thought of it from that, but it so much happened because of that interaction. Right.
You know what it felt like? It felt like the, like, belated sequel to a movie. Like it was like there, like it was like Tron Legacy. Like you kind of know these characters, right? You remember, and you're waiting for that big moment where they're finally in the room together again. It's like, no, I don't know them at all.
No, you're right. And then in that whole scene is bananas because they meet for the first time. Like it's just a thing. They're already talking crap to each other. Then they get framed and they don't stop quipping.
No. Mm-mm.
They seem very nonplussed by the fact that all of these other cops are about to arrest them for murder. Like they're not like Kurt Russell's like a little annoyed. But he gets like more pissed at Stallone than he does at the fact that he's literally just been framed for murder.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It never, at no point do they seem like, to the point where I was like, oh, they must be pretty sure they're not going to go to jail for this. But then it becomes clear they are. And they're both just like, oh, man. At one point on their way into jail, Stallone makes a wedgie joke.
Yes.
Like he's like, oh, I have. I'm like, that's all right. I don't know what I'm supposed to feel right now.
Yeah, my sense, and because you'd mentioned it earlier, was that, you know, with Stallone getting so much of the early screen time, I think that this was Stallone wanting his own Lethal Weapon because he had done a lot of these like solo vehicles. He did all the Rambos, he did Cobra, he does all the Rocky movies, and then he sees like Lethal Weapon super popular, and he's like, oh, I need to do that. Right. You know, I still got to be the star. Let's not get crazy. But I need like I want to try out this like witty cop banter shtick, and that's where like because he's also, you know, he's a writer and he's known to like, you know, take over screenplays all the time. Like I got to imagine that is 100% his call to be like, we got to have jokes. We just got to have jokes everywhere.
Well, I think so that's where this like my I know a lot about Stallone, but like surrounding it and not the actual like. So when I first saw him, my reaction was like, okay, this makes sense. He's in a suit. He has glasses on. Like that was definitely something that he came to the movie with because he was trying to like change his persona, I think, at that time and be more intellectual and like to show people like, hey guys, I'm not actually Rocky. I'm a person and I can do other things.
It doesn't work. But it doesn't work. It's so sad. I think Kurt Russell should have been the uptight one. I don't know. With the hair, I don't think you can.
Yeah, you can't. That hair can't be tamed. Yeah,
no. I think I was really thinking about this throughout. Like, can Stallone, can he do comedy? Can he play that role? I think he can. I just think someone has to write it. Because he is a naturally funny person. Like, if you ever see him interview, he does have timing and can make jokes. Mm-hmm. It just did not fit the character. Like, he did not fit what they were trying to do. It also didn't make sense. this is not James Bond. Why are you in a suit and you have glasses on during this? Like, it just didn't make any sense.
Well, I did appreciate them sort of talking about that in the movie. Like, I feel like it was Kurt Russell that was like, they were showing clips. I can't recall because, you know, like I didn't just watch it, but I don't remember. There was a part where he was doing a bust and he was wearing the suit and everybody around him, he's in the center of it. So to me, that part, I was like, I kind of like that they don't take that part like too seriously because they made sure to be like, yeah, this is what he does. Like he's in the middle of this bus with his gun looking all suave, you know, and everything. I do feel like some of it really worked. Some of the lines, his delivery on some of them really worked. Like, but then in other cases, I was like, I don't.
Oh my gosh. I just had this moment of inspiration because Kurt Russell's hair looks, he's dressed like Riggs from Lethal Weapon.
Yeah.
And that's why Stallone's in the suit because he's trying to be Murtaugh.
Right. Yeah.
He's just not old enough to do the I'm going to retire shtick. So he's going to be like, oh, I just want to focus on my stocks. And, you know, like that. Oh my gosh. That, like, I don't know why it took me this many viewings and 40 minutes of us talking to have that realization. But, like, he wants to be Danny Glover. He's like, he's the one bringing the gravitas to the movie.
Well, I think that's true, except that the writing was such that there was literally no difference between the characters. Like, their lines were utterly interchangeable. Like, you could change them and it wouldn't matter.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah, you're right. And those character types that we're talking about, in case you haven't seen it, they go away, like, as soon as they get arrested. Like, aside from, like, one scene of Stallone reading the paper in jail, like, they don't, like, his knowledge of stocks, his like intellect or style never comes up again in the movie. It's not like a defining character trait. It's just to give you the idea that they're different. And then once they're together, you're right. They might as well just be the same person.
Yeah. I mean, and his glasses, I think, come and go arbitrarily. I'm trying to think, maybe they just go away when he's in prison, but I feel like they come back once in a while too. I should have taken more notes on that because the glasses thing kind of just, I didn't understand it. I mean, I know that there are cops that wear glasses, but it just seemed kind of strange.
Well, it was a fashion choice. I don't know. I'm just making this up now.
And then, like, when it was convenient, he just didn't have glasses. And I'm just like, is he putting in contacts in and out? I don't
know. Like you said it. So again, I go back to the buddy stuff, and it made, like, I'm thinking about like Beverly Hills Cop. And how there's this, that one scene with, I don't know, have y'all seen that? Everybody seen Beverly Hills Cop?
Yeah.
Okay. I was like, this is something like a spoiler, but maybe not. But do you remember when they got back to the precinct after everything went down at the club with the robbery and stuff? Mm-hmm. How Eddie Murphy just spun this lie, just like on the spot about how brave the two were. And this whole bit, and you're just like, but seeing the chief want to believe it. And then they both like confess it's not true. And then he's like, it was a really good lie, guys. Like a really so I kind of feel like I was waiting for that moment in Tango and Cash where it would be like a kind of a nod and a like, fine, you know, whatever, for them to kind of stand alone in their characterizations, like you said. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it, I need to watch it again, but I feel like I didn't quite get it. Because, you know, like you said, once they went down, they became two parts of the same coin, if that makes sense.
Right.
Like, and honestly, a double-sided coin that's the same, you know, like, you know, like Two-Face, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
It was a good time, but I don't see any sort of classic moments for me. Like how I just pulled that one, that is a classic moment to me from that movie.
Well, and the traditional buddy cop movie is like, let's learn how our differences help make us a great team. Mm-hmm. The lesson in this one is basically them learning that they're the same person.
Mm-hmm.
Like they don't, so they're like, that's the, they're not that, oh, I'll use your intellect and my strength or yada yada to make us a good team. It's like, no, we're just really good cops. We're just going to, you know, we're just going to blow everything up together.
Well, he was like, when he thought Kurt Russell was like, you know, with his sister, mm-hmm. and then how Kurt was like, oh, that's your sister. Whoo, almost like, whoo, that's like, do you have any loyalty to each other? Like, that scene, I was like, are you friends? Or, cause you know, at that point you think, oh, they bonded. They've both been electrocuted together. They slid down this pole. They're still cracking joke. Nobody broke anything. And then, you know, like they separate, come back together, and he's like, "Ooh, good thing that's not his girlfriend." It's like, what's happening?
Since you brought it, I mean, that was such an odd reveal. Like when they introduce his sister, the whole scene, I was like, something is playing really weird about this scene. Like, I don't understand. And I didn't know what they were supposed to be to each other. And I was like, I think I'm not supposed to know, but I also don't know why I'm not supposed to know. And then all of a sudden, like all the way at the end of the movie, like, that's why, because now it's his sister. Isn't that great? And it's like, I guess it's kind of a strange reveal. Like,
yeah, she comes off as his daughter when he's talking about the dancing, like in his office, like, well, yeah, I don't want you to go dancing.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's Stallone overestimating how much close in age he thinks he is to Terry Hatcher in that yeah. moment. Because I think he's going to be like, oh, yeah, they're going to think we're boyfriend and girlfriend, but it's really my sister. But no, you're right. He talks to her like
that's his daughter. And it's very confusing when you find out, oh, it's his sister. So I guess then you have to look back in their family life, like what happened to the parents. The parents must have died like a long time ago, and he had to raise her. I've got that backstory covered. All right.
The rest of this podcast is just going to be Donna filling in the backstory.
That's
of
Tango. Right.
I'm intrigued.
Tango and
I've got it.
Fiction.
I'm making it up right now.
Yeah.
Who are we shipping? What's happening?
But yeah. Okay. So you mentioned the sequence. I think we got to talk about, because there's so much, meat on the bone here. And that is the entire prison sequence. So Tango and Cash, we mentioned they get set up and they get arrested. They get convicted. They actually plead guilty in a trial that happens very quickly. I should just point out, this whole movie takes place over the span of like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Because Jack Palance talks about like in 2 weeks, we're going to have this big shipment come in. And that's why they're supposed to be out. So they are in 2 weeks. They are set up, tried, convicted, sent to prison, break out, infiltrate, and kill the bad guy. That's efficiency.
That is.
Yeah.
Well done.
And never once stop joking about it. Like, no, they don't even contemplate.
They were super upbeat the whole time. Even when they were getting electrocuted, I'm pretty sure he was screaming his name. Maybe that was the only time. When it was Kurt Russell's turn, just kept screaming his name while he was being electrocuted.
The whole prison sequence is just so. I kept thinking of this SNL bit. It's an old one with when Jerry Seinfeld was on, and it was also when the show Oz was on HBO. Yeah, mm-hmm. And the whole premise is that Jerry, as Jerry from Seinfeld, is on. Because at the end of the series of Seinfeld, they go to prison, right? So the idea is that they're in the same prison as Oz. Mm-hmm. And there's one scene where Jerry is sitting with one of the characters and asks him, "Hey, how's it going?" And the guy goes, "I think I just got stabbed with an AIDS-infected needle." And it's like really serious. And Jerry goes, "Good luck with all that." And then the joke is that this is a sitcom character in a very serious movie. And I kept thinking, like, that's the world that this movie takes place in.
It is. you are 100% right. Because, yeah, they don't take I think aside from getting electrocuted, they take nothing seriously. The only time the two times Stallone gets mad in this movie when he's about to get electrocuted to death and he thinks Kurt Russell's going to bang his sister.
Yeah.
Everything else, he's like, send me to jail? Fine. Send me to prison? Okay, fine, I guess. Oh, I'm in prison. Everybody wants to kill me? Whatever. And the prison they get sent to. So the twist is they plead guilty because they think they're going to go to like some, you know, white-collar minimum security prison.
For murder, though.
For murder of a federal agent.
Voluntary manslaughter or something that they pled for. Yeah, that's...
Yeah, 18 months. Like, that is an amazing... They had the best lawyer. Mm-hmm. In LA. So they get 18 months. They think they're going, but they, you know, everybody gets paid off, because that's the other thing. Every cop in this movie is crooked other than Tango and Cash and their like captains, because everyone's getting paid off. Everyone's helping. Like, so they get railroaded. They get sent to like this super max, like the worst of the worst prison.
But what's funny is it's the Supermax, but they have access to fire. Like, the prison is on fire when they walk in. And nobody's doing anything about that.
There is, it's a ticker tape parade of garbage.
Yeah. I was going to say, they have, that's a lot of stuff. It was just like coming down and.
And the guards are like,
this
just happens.
Like, it is what you would define as a prison riot, I think, is going on.
Like, that should be on lockdown. Yeah. Like,
except even the guards aren't reacting. They're just like, this is prison, right?
Typical Wednesday. Yeah, because and it's not even like it's like they're all allowed to just throw stuff from their cells because it's raining down. Yeah, there are legit fires going on behind them. There's bonfires happening. Everyone is nonplussed by this.
I mean, honestly, it was kind of neat in the frame. Like, if you paused it and saw like a shot, it was kind of like bonfire. You know, something's flying through. They're both center frame holding their. You know, so it's not. But it definitely doesn't look like a prison.
No. Yeah, no, you're right. It looks cool as hell.
It's meant to scare young children from wanting to, you know, do bad things to get in prison. Like, it scared me straight.
As Donna, your mom laughed in the background. Yeah.
Donna was on a wayward path. That's a whole
other
podcast.
I saw that prison on fire, and I thought, oh, man.
That won't be me.
Donna in the 80s is a whole other podcast. That's our serial there. That's the next season they're gonna do, but and so yeah, everybody's yelling at him, and then the guards just go away, so that Tango and Cash can be abducted, blindfolded, tied up, electrocuted.
Why
in
do
this,
they even bother blindfolding them? Like, where are you gonna take them? Like, that they don't need to see where they're going. Like, oh, surprise, it's the laundry room.
You know, we don't want you to, we don't want you, this prison that you've been in for 24 hours, not even 24 hours.
Right.
I didn't
and
even
it's
think
like,
about that.
Then they all take the thing off their head so they can see who's beating them up. So even if it was so that they couldn't recognize them, they take it off so they can see them.
Yeah, it was literally just so they couldn't see the laundry chute itself.
Yeah.
Inside of the laundry chute. Mm-hmm.
Oh, that's just 100% so you can do have a stunt double do that and not make that look fake.
Okay.
There is no script reason. Yeah, that's what that is.
Because Stallone and Kurt Russell can't even go down a slide themselves. I mean,
not with their hands tied behind their back. Yeah, I'm not breaking my neck on Tango and Cash.
It's liability.
It's the coming out of the slide that they would have gotten broken.
Right.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Well, then that's the other thing. The villain, he's like this big, you know, scary shadow, and then he's in there, and then he just like melts into the shadows. I was like, how did he get in and how did he get out? And no one knows. It's like, how close is this to LA that he can just be there? You know, like, if usually when you're transporting, you know, you're taking them, and this is supposed to be a prison where they can't find them, right? Or something to that effect. Like, there's
Lost. Yeah.
They got lost. So then it's like, where are they? Because he's like, I'm here. And it's like, and nobody's trying to.
Yeah.
Like, you know, there's a man here with a lot of money, or, you know, get out. That whole scene kind of cracked me up because I was just like, and then the guards, like you said, suddenly the guards appeared from wherever they were. All of them were there.
They were allowed to break it up because the ward, that like assistant warden guy comes in, but it's like, where were you guys like literally 5 minutes ago? And what was the plan? Like, the plan was the plan had to have been to like kill them, but they don't like, they're really slow about it. Yeah. This is like the biggest. Every single time the bad guy could kill Tango and Cash, he doesn't. To the point where even like Tango and Cash are asking this question, they're like, why doesn't he just kill us?
He keeps giving like these reasons that he's like, oh, well, you'll see, or wouldn't it be like, he acts like he has a reason, but it's never revealed as to why. He like, he's like, they're like rats in a cage.
Yeah, like the plan makes sense up till the prison. Like, I get it. You frame him for a crime, you get him sent to prison, you kill them in prison, where everybody would be like, it's kind of the perfect crime because you're like, well, yeah, you're going to throw him into prison with a bunch of guys that they locked up. Of course, they're probably not going to make it out. But that all makes sense until the moment where he literally just walks away and is like, they've learned their lesson. We're good. We're good here. We're going to move on.
Or the other police came.
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah. Right. And so, yeah. And the last thing about that prison sequence, too, is, and you pointed this out, and I didn't notice it till this most recent watch. So they're fighting in this laundry room that they get taken down to, but there are also like bars. So
with arms coming through. So there's a jail cell.
There are cells in the laundry room?
Yeah.
No one who made this movie has set foot in a prison. I'm kind of convinced.
No, I 100% endorse. I don't think they understand how prisons work, or
unless that was like the gate to like block people out of the laundry room. But clearly, it didn't do a lot of good because people still got in it.
Nope.
They also don't understand how electricity works, how much it takes to kill somebody. There's two electricity scenes in the movie, and it's like they shot that first one where they put these giant cables into the water, and just in case any kids are watching, that would immediately kill you. I don't know. Yeah.
That's right.
It's not like they act like it's like that Rambo scene where he's being electrocuted by like these little car batteries, and it's like, no, that would just immediately, you would be dead. but it was like they did that, and then later on they wanted to electrocute somebody else, and like, well, we already showed someone being electrocuted by this massive amount of electricity and not dying, so he needs to get thrown into like a giant like transformer. I don't know what the heck it even was.
Wasn't it raining?
It's raining the whole time they're walking through it anyway. Yeah. Like, don't touch that.
Ooh. And he just gets thrown into this giant thing, and it's like, that would kill you, but so would the other thing. I don't know.
Well, I think what makes it even like richer is when they're on the roof and Kurt Russell's like, we're not going to get electric. Do you know how electric? He said, did you know how electricity works or something like that? He's like, as long as you're not touching the ground and the wire, you won't. Then he goes, right? Like, he didn't know.
It doesn't. Yeah. Yeah.
And I thought that is perfect because I'm with you. Like, listen, I've watched Grey's Anatomy. There was an electrocution scene on that. The person went down. Like, it was very quick. So I was like, thanks to my TV knowledge of medicine, I am aware that you're not going to shake like that. But I really wondered about that on the scene. I'm like, Kirk doesn't know. Does anyone know? I'm like, does a belt, like, there? I thought he was going to use the belt to get up there. And I thought, okay, that's maybe pushing credulity, but okay. But they put them in their mouths. Right. And then they
grab onto it.
Yeah, I was like,
so by the time he adds the second hand, wouldn't that have electrocuted him? Because now it's a completed circuit, or before he did it?
at some point, you would
hurt yourself.
That's what I'm saying. I wondered about the ground thing. I'm like, this, because that sounds familiar. The circuit, I mean, like you said, a complete circuit.
It feels like it could be true, because squirrels don't die.
This is true. They just be running across.
They walk on electricity all the time, okay. But they're only touching one.
Mm-hmm.
But, and they're also kind of making a complete circuit with all of their feet. So it's like going in and coming out. So it's just like passing through.
Yeah. But, no, you, this all checks out 100%.
That's why. That's a good scene. Cause it makes you be like, oh, you know, like, he doesn't know. I don't know. We're rooting for you to make it, though.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly.
But you're right. Some other scenes, it's like,
I'm
no one.
I'm trying to check my magic school bus references of electricity. Now, what did Miss Frizzle teach us about that?
Yeah. More than anything, the fall that then they take from that wire, because
they should be dead.
It's like a couple stories, wasn't
it? Yeah.
But maybe it's because it was such a rain-soaked ground. It cushioned them as they fell, and that's why no one is broken. But then again, Kurt Russell threw himself out his window onto the pavement, landed on his leg to go after that guy that was in his apartment, right? Got up and ran, and it didn't bother him. So they're good.
This is true. I mean, look, like, it's...
Just shake it off.
Yeah, exactly. That's
men don't feel pain. That's what their machismo is saying.
Well, if you watch them, I think they really did get the wind knocked out of them. I think Stallone did. When he dropped, he looked like, oh, like when he actually landed. And I was like, you did your own stunt. I know you did, because that's what, you know, Stallone does. So I was like, I wonder if he was like, we went about a yard too high on that drop. I kind of felt that, because I thought he was going to say, Aldrin, he didn't. But I was like, oh, that looks like it actually hurt. Like, Kurt Russell kind of was like, all right, you know, but then Stallone kind of looked like, I need a second, you know, because.
Yeah. Maybe the scene was shot first and that's why they had to use the pillowcases. Stallone's back couldn't take it.
The thing about Stallone in this movie, though, is that it just wasn't his kind of action. Like, he is a very, like, physical action. Like, mm-hmm. when he does action, he does, like, get into the mm-hmm. scene and he does, like, but it's a very, like hands-on, like, brutal kind of thing. And mm-hmm. I don't know what, I couldn't understand what kind of action this movie was really going for, because there, at one point it was kind of like sort of a martial arts kind of karate type thing going on. And it was kind of like, but he was trying to engage in it, but clearly didn't know any moves. It was very strange. Like, yeah. It all felt very stilted, which is not usual. Like, he usually understands the action in the movie, but it seemed like he didn't care about that. Like, he was just like, whatever, like that was all phoned in.
Yeah, no, you're right, because yeah, that his style of action is either, you know, it's either Rocky, it's punching, it's like hand to hand combat, but not, you know, or it's big guns and explosions. Right. But yeah, like in that final sequence, he's like having to fight a karate guy, which again is another 80s staple, because they're like, well, karate's a thing, we got to have somebody in there doing some sweet karate moves, but they're going up against Sylvester Stallone, who does not know karate at all, and couldn't, was not bothered to really learn for that sequence. No. But I think I think he doesn't know what he's trying. I think he wants to be like the cool, he wanted this to be the cool action movie as opposed to like the gritty action movies that he'd been doing. But right. it doesn't land, to the point too where that one of my favorite characters in the movie brings out the James Bond homage that they apparently wanted, because this movie has their own Q, and that is in the form of Owen. And you would think that Owen, this is where, you know, they've just forgotten who the characters are. You think that Owen, who's Mr. like high tech expensive gadgetry, would be the one who was working with Tango, because he's the expensive, like highbrow guy. But no, like this gritty, like downtown LA cop also has like spy shit. Like that's like all the gun boots and all that sort of stuff.
Oh, the car.
Mm-hmm.
Right. The guy who created the, which I'm going to say, I think the car ages pretty well. I thought it looked pretty impressive still. I was like, I can't really tell what model you are, but the whole black sleek, you know, look to it. I was mm-hmm. like, that could work.
I'm just wondering why they never got pulled over for having like this massive gun, because they had to drive a really long while to the compound.
Yeah, the drive from Owens to the quarry is, I mean, like
how far enough to not have enough gas by like 3 minutes into the compound.
Is this pre-Hummer is the question, right? Because once you started seeing Hummers, which were you know, people are like, those look like tanks. Well, you know, mm-hmm. so I wonder, they're like, oh, it's a Hummer. we're used to those. Yeah, those windows are black.
But that whole sequence was just, like, I was just like, where is this coming from? Why do they nothing in the script even dictated that they needed gadgets at that point. Like, why did all of a sudden, like, oh yeah, by the way, I got this guy and we have a special future car. Like, and no one even batted an eye. It was just like, all right, cool. Yeah, of course. Because we're LA cops and we all have like an underground guy who has like gadgets.
Yeah. That Cash can go to, which by the way, they've escaped from prison. It was in the paper, in one of the many papers. No one in LA gives a shit because he walks into, there's all these other people working on stuff. Owen sees him, but presumably everybody else who's also working with the police sees him, and no one like bats an eye. Like Tango's walking in broad daylight in and out of buildings. Like no one is. No one
in their car in the middle until of the street. The club. Just abandoned.
When he got to the club, when he went to look for Brittany, or is her name Brittany? Was that her name? Or Catherine?
Catherine.
Until Catherine. And then it was like the sirens went off. It was like the silent alarm. Because the next thing you know, there's cops in the club. And she's like, okay. So yeah. Until he tried to find Catherine. You're right. He went mm-hmm. under the radar without being under the radar at all. Mm-hmm.
I wasn't even sure why they split up. Like, they got out of prison, and then they just, it wasn't even a conversation about it.
No.
We're just kind of like, all right, so, like, if you need me,
Check, I'll be no, here. Look I'll for Catherine. Here,
but
let's
see you
solve
around.
Our crime separately.
Yeah. You're the only person I know I can trust to not be a crooked cop who helps set me up. See you down the
See,
road.
I thought they split so that they would have a harder time tracking both of them down.
I think that's true. Mm-hmm. I just don't know that it...
They didn't say
it. Yeah, no, it totally yeah. doesn't.
Right. Or that they at least needed a line where they explain, hey, I'm going to go find this guy. Well, I'm going to go find this guy, because that's what they do. And it kind of makes sense. Hey, let's split up. You go, I'm going to find the guy right. who made the tapes. And because, you know, Tango finds the FBI guy that got paid off. Cash goes and find the guy who made the sound, who's able to fabricate like a deep fake audio clip of the two of them. It makes sense why they're split up, but yeah, you're right. They know, they just assume like it's a plan that happens in a deleted scene.
Yeah. And why wasn't Catherine's house ever monitored? Like the boss knew he was there. So why isn't anyone watching that house for an escape?
Yeah. You would think Jack Palance would be like, hey, even the police, they're like, these guys just got out. Maybe we should go to the one known relative either of these people have.
Check that out first.
even if you can rationalize like why it kind of makes sense for them to split up, which it does, it's an interesting choice for your buddy cop movie to just suddenly, once you get them together, to like they finally just kind of are on the same page at that moment, right? They decide they can trust each other, and it's like, all right, let's split them up for a while.
Mm-hmm.
They're getting a little too cozy.
Well, the separation happens. You're right. You're going to go your separate ways eventually, but and then come back together, because that's part of it, right?
Yeah, right.
We're too different, or you go, you know. But you're right. They did it backwards in this. They were separate. They brought them together. They knocked them down together. They sent them to prison together. They got out together. And then they're like, all right, let's solve this separately. And we'll come back.
Or like, even if you had them get into a fight at that moment, like it's just like, you know what? I can't even deal with you anymore. Like just go. And then like when they come back together, it's like they need each other. Right. But there was
only the rooftop scene with the fake grenade. Did we get the, I can't be a part of this year two, the bad and badder cop moment.
But that was all a thing. That was a ruse.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. That's the only thing we got is like you're saying, that was our one time where we saw them be like, this, I can't even go that far, or I'm too different or whatever. You're right. The rest of it, we didn't get it. Mm-hmm. It wasn't there.
But even that was like they had done that before a million times. It's like, wait, isn't this the first time you guys are working together?
I'm so confused. So many questions.
Yeah. I think want to surprise the audience. I think that's really what it is. It's like, we need to keep the audience guessing about everything.
Right. So, but yeah, because like at some point then they have to talk that through. They're like, okay, you're going to show up here. You're going to show up, and then we're going to play the good cop, bad cop thing where you're going
to
be the...
That was in the car ride over. We didn't need to see that. It's okay.
Yeah.
We didn't see them take dumps, but we know that happened too. So
okay. Your logic is flawless. I can't.
Don't have to see everything to know what happened.
If they start to spin this off into like a TV series, Donna's got all the episodes. They're all going to fill in those little gaps, like Star Wars is doing with all the little time periods between movies.
There you go.
She's going to fill in the time gaps between scenes.
That's fantastic. Yeah, well, and that leads us again. All of those are just everything we're talking about is just such a classic 80s staple, the good cop, bad cop scene, the rooftop scene, the prison break, and even the nightclub scene, which that nightclub scene, I mean, that thing is wild. Like, because again, that's totally Beverly Hills Cop, because in both of those, they, you know, Axel Foley takes the guys to a strip club. So it's like, oh, we got to have a scene. We got to figure out a way to get like some sexy ladies in this, because we haven't had enough,
actually stripping. In Beverly Hills or no?
They were actually in Beverly Hills Cop. They were actual strippers.
I think in the first one they were. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
These women didn't strip. They rode their motorcycle, and then she came out with a fan and did some dance, and then she went away. But everybody in the back was topless. So like only the nakedness happens in the dressing room. Like,
sure.
That's the strangest strip club.
Well, I mean, it was true. Okay. So I guess it's an upscale burlesque establishment. How about that?
But it wasn't even burlesque. Like they didn't know.
I got nothing. Like,
the people who made this movie have never seen a prison, and they have never seen a strip club. No, we're just estimating what those things might be.
Right. Because you know what I really want if I go to a strip club? I don't need to see any girls get naked. I need to see them dance with fans and drum badly.
Yes. She is a bad drummer.
There was a drum scene. I was like, is she playing the drums?
She was at the start when it was bad, but then when you only saw like the tops of her drumsticks, that's when she was not playing.
She's playing the drums in the way our 9-year-old plays the drums, which is like just wild abandon and no like concept of, it's just like boo, blah, blah. Like, Terry Hatcher is talented at many things. I don't think drumming was her forte. They gave, and I'm sure they even gave her like, she's like, what am I going to do with these? Like, I'm just beat the things. It's fine. So Kurt Russell goes and finds Terry Hatcher there to get back in touch with Stallone, which again, as you pointed out, Nick, it's like they split up only so like not even a day later, he's now looking for Tango.
Right.
Like maybe they just shouldn't have split up in the first place. If like you're going to find him, it's like,
well, and I think that's what I mean. It's like maybe I could see how it could make sense. It's just the movie does nothing with it anyway. So why even insert that? Like, it's like you're saying, it's like, I think it's like 2 minutes of screen time, 5 minutes of screen time.
Right. Exactly. Because
that equals more blow up time.
That does. Yeah. It gives us a chance.
So we can have a lot of blowing up of things.
Yes. And there's plenty of blowing up. But yeah, you've got it. And then the wildest choice, maybe of all of these movies, is to just set up a scenario where we can get Kurt Russell in drag.
Yeah. That might be, like, you were talking about how this is the last movie of the 80s. That might be the high watermark of the, I mean, that might just, like, that's it. If you want to know what the 80s were, look at this clip of Kurt Russell in drag. I don't know, like, it just seems, that was the scene that made me go, kind of like we said at the beginning, like what Donna was, I'm glad this movie exists. Because I don't know another movie where I would just see that just happen and not be like a focal point. It just is.
Yeah, it's there. Yeah, for next to no reason. Like, they basically write that scene specifically to get him in drag.
Yeah.
That's the only real reason that it happens. And it's like, whose idea was this? Was this Kurt Russell's idea? Was this like...
Maybe it was just to pull a gag so that we could make it more of a humorous...
Right. Well, that's the thing. I can imagine that if the original director wanting this to be a more serious movie gets to that scene and is like, oh, wait a minute. We're doing, no, I'm sorry. I don't want any part of this.
That made the director put that scene in itself.
Kurt Russell walks out of his trailer in full drag going, what do you mean? I'm already.
Yeah.
We got to do it.
I waxed for this.
Yeah.
His legs are very smooth.
He has lovely legs.
I have to say, this might be the good... I think Kurt Russell, I think he was great. The whole, like, I think he did exactly what he was asked to do. He did it really well. I think that the movie around him was not good, but I like what he did with the role. I thought he was trying. I could be wrong.
No, you're right. No, I agree with you. I think Kurt is great. I think he's very good in this. And I don't think Stallone's bad in this. I just think I think he's a little miscast. I think he's trying on a new persona and it doesn't take. Which he's going to do a lot of in the next couple of years. Cause the next couple of movies he's going to do are Oscar and Stopper, My Mom Will Shoot. He's going to do Rocky V. Like this is like a weird experimental period for Stallone and it just doesn't work. But the one thing I'll say about him is that the dude always commits. Yeah. Like you can never like accuse him of being lazy. He's just sometimes not right for what he's doing. But Kurt Russell's 100% right for this role.
Yeah.
Like he's great in it. And I think if you think of Kurt Russell, like in his like movie star persona, this role comes to mind because it just kind of fits him in that way.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with that. Yeah. And I agree with you. I didn't think Stallone was necessarily bad. It's just like nothing he was doing, like he didn't have the context for that character, and also he just wasn't enough for him to do with it, and it just wasn't really the right character for him to begin with.
Yeah.
So all of that together just makes it not work, you know? But like you're saying, I think he is committing to it pretty hard.
Sure. All right. So let's make sure I want to circle back to, because the other scene that we skipped over was that opening chase scene in the parking garage, which again packs in so much, like, in its, like, it's, again, it's amazing how many cliches this movie packs in such a, like, it is a tight package of like 80s cliches. And that scene, you've got like this random car chase where everything's getting destroyed. It's taking place in a parking garage, which I feel like there was lots of like action movies that had parking garage scenes. And so you work that in, you get like the random, like they hit the one car and the woman's topless. So you got like random 80s boobs. Then you have like the Russian immigrant who's mad and he like yells at him in Russian, and that it's everything. And that's, it's just like so compact. And that's in the first like 5 minutes of this movie. And I think that's a good calling card to where this, what this movie's trying to be, which is that just we're throwing literally everything we can think of at you.
Well, I would say, for me, the beginning, it's Stallone's whole bringing down the 18-wheeler thing.
Yes.
So like, so the first thing that popped into my head is when you can hear the guy telling him, you're out of our jurisdiction. And he's, what he should say is, you need to stop. But instead, he's like, whatever you're going to do, do it fast, you know. So then he somehow gets around this big 18-wheeler, pulls it. And then what I remember is the scene of the truck coming up the crest or whatever. And the, like, squeak. And I was like, well, that's not a classic 80s like, shot. I don't know what it is. And then this whole, like, him posing in front of his car and the shooting and the whatever. So you're... That made a more of an impact for me than the car chase in the parking garage. I'm not sure why so much as maybe it just caught me so off guard that we got one of those iconic scenes of the, you know, the truck. I was like, I've seen that so many times. I didn't expect to see this here, you know, and then even with the banter. So like, I do think that they were trying to give us background, you know, give us that character profile of Stallone when he was, you know, talking to CHP and whoever else, and they're jeering because he didn't, there were no drugs, and then he turns around and shoots the truck and cocaine comes out. And I was like, can you just turn around and shoot things? Like, stuff like that. So by the time we got to Russell, I was almost expecting, I don't know, I think I was expecting a little more, because I was like, Stallone gave us a lot in his opening. We got a lot. The dudes flew out of the windshield. You know, the truck didn't crumple on itself. Because I'm like, has anyone ever seen an 18-wheeler stop on a dime?
Well, and they had to put it in park, because as soon as they flew out of the window, the truck would have still kept going.
Right.
It was completely stopped.
So much was happening.
But also, that was like a weird sequence for me, because it was almost like they wanted to make it that him standing there forced them to stop short, but also he shot at them at the same time. It was almost like a Greedo Han Solo situation, like what stopped which or who stopped first. But my other thing is, like, if your premise is that they, like, how bad are these guys that they were like, but wouldn't have, like, if you wanted to be scared for Stallone, I mean, maybe this makes me sound ruthless, but if they were really bad guys, wouldn't they have not cared if they hit him? Like, but right. It seems like that's what they were really concerned about, was hitting
him.
Unless
the thing had gasoline in it. So
but it had cocaine in it, didn't it?
Well, the bottom half, the first two ones that they checked had gasoline.
Mm-hmm. Oh, right.
So
right.
It was combustible. So that might be the reason.
Okay.
But I also think it's necessary to show how clean Tango was.
Oh, yeah.
He even how he takes something down.
Yeah.
And then Kurt Russell Cash just tears up, makes everything a hot mess. And then he comes in, takes off clothes at work and grabs this, you know,
random slice of pizza. Yeah.
Yeah. Random slice of pizza that for some reason someone's walking around with the lid open, and then gets upset that someone steals a slice. Then goes into his candy drawer with granola bars.
Right.
A choice for Cash, but his old woman candy, and gets the messy t-shirt on. Like, I think it was purposeful to show how different they are.
They're different styles. He wears glasses.
That's right.
That was what they, I could tell when they were writing the script, someone was like, what's the difference between these characters? I don't understand, Bill. He likes pizza. He wears glasses. Can you even picture them in the same room?
I think they're thinking the Odd Couple. Like, this is Felix and Oscar. Like, this one's dirty. This one's clean.
But yeah, that opening sequence felt like the opening to a Bond movie almost. Like, it was that, like, especially the way Stallone was, like, in a suit, and he was, like, very suave about the whole thing, and, like, calm and collected, but there was all this, like, chaos going on.
Well, then he had, wasn't it a luxury car he was driving?
Yeah.
I was like, when he put the siren on, I was a little bit confused. I was like, where is he from? Or police, if he's on a police pursuit, you know, why is he driving a convertible? You know, so then, like you said, because he's Beverly Hills, he's
undercover suave.
He's literally a Beverly Hills cop.
And they really need to put him in a sports car so he can get in front of that truck, because, like, he pulls over, he gets out, and then they wait for him to come up the hill. And it's like, when did he get that far ahead? Yeah, like, when did that happen?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then there was a helicopter. I'm like, you're not going to lose the truck.
Right. Well, and there's this weird, it's kind of like a Bad Boy situation where, like, he doesn't even have to be a cop because he's really rich, right, or something, right? They like reference that slightly, but they never comes back again.
I did wonder about that, because they were like, you don't have to do this or something like that, right? Yeah. Why do you do this? Because it's fun or something like that. Yeah.
He just like, well, of course he loves it because he's not upset about anything that happens to him. Like,
I wish I could have his zenness.
Yeah.
Like, nothing bothers him.
Yeah. Nothing at all. Like, he is staring death in the eye so many times, and he, like, is just nonplussed for the whole movie, unless you mess with his sister. That's when he draws the line. You mess with his sister, then he gets upset a little bit. Then he'll smash a door down. All right. So are there any other scenes or moments that we haven't covered yet that you got in your notes, or that you're really, really dying to talk about? Nick, let's start with you.
I guess I have two. I have one. I wrote down a couple lines, but there's one line I, like, highlighted because I think it sums up, like, how strange the dialogue was and the jokes that they're making.
I wonder if it's the same one I have, but go ahead.
So they're in court, and there's a witness on the stand, and the guy's there, and I think Stallone says something like, we're going to have to pay a visit to Jabba the Hutt when we get out of here. Like, which is, like, seems totally uncalled for. Like, and then Kurt Russell replies, I'll bring the chainsaw. Which is like, what are you going to do to this guy? And then I think Stallone says, I'll bring the beer. Is this a thing that they do? Like, cut people up? I don't understand. And then just have beer? I don't understand the joke. Like, that's the kind of humor the whole movie was, though. It was like this weird banter of inside jokes or just like...
For people who just met.
Right. And supposedly don't like each other that much.
Yeah, it was like the only thing that even made the jokes even remotely funny was the pacing, and that's it. Like it was like someone understood the pacing of banter, but they didn't they just wrote random words in. Like, ad-libbed it.
Right. Yeah.
It's like Mad Lib.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
I mean, yeah.
Yeah. Nope. You're right. No, that's not the one that I had. The one that I had, which I think was just because it's so corny, is when he is confronting Louis Arquette's character, the shady FBI guy, and he goes, "You're looking terribly anemic. I think you need a little more iron in your diet." As he's pointing the gun, I was like, I feel bad for everyone involved in that moment. I felt bad watching that. I felt bad for Stallone, like, saying that and having, like, and again, if anybody ever questions the acting chops of one Sylvester Stallone, watch him deliver that line with the utmost sincerity, like trying to make that work. And it does not.
It does not. He doesn't. I wonder if he got up after that. He's like, nailed it. That was great.
Yeah, that was a good one.
Cut. Let's take that.
All right. Katrina, how about you? Do you got any moments or scenes we've missed?
There were just a lot. I stopped really trying to track all of the different one-liners that stood out. I feel like there was, like, a Rambo reference, though.
There was. Yes.
That
there was,
I
right
thought
before
was
he shot the tanker.
Yeah. I was like, you know, I just, that one kind of tickled me a little bit, because part of me really felt like they didn't take themselves too seriously. Mm-hmm. But then it's like you said, I would never say that Stallone doesn't take his role seriously though, because he does. He does commit to whatever he's doing. So, so that part I appreciated. So I was like, they have to know there's so many other films that come to mind as you watch these.
That line, I think, was one of the, like, one of the reasons I loved this movie as a kid, because I thought it was like the most genius line ever. Cause like he calls Rambo a pussy, and I'm like, oh, he just called Rambo a pussy, but he played Rambo. He referenced, the thing he did, and he's like talking shit about him. I'm like, oh, and like, so like 11-year-old me thought that was like the most brilliant line of dialogue ever. And I think that's probably one of the reasons I loved this movie as a kid, was because, yeah, you're right, it doesn't take itself, this movie doesn't take itself seriously at all. It's just meant to be a lot of fun. And like that kind of line in the first scene lets you know that it's going to be that.
That's funny, because I didn't even remember that that was what the line was. Yeah. Because, well, you know, similar to you, Donna, like I grew up in a house where like we didn't cuss or anything. Like we weren't allowed to watch rated R. So if I had seen the movie, I probably would have remembered the line probably a little differently. You look probably a little differently than the "this is a night," but more like, gosh, like I can't believe. So like, even if I were to tell one of my parents now that that's the line, I remember a reference to Rocky, and then find out that's the context, they would be like, Trina. But just the fact, I think I just liked that it was a little bit meta, you know, in a way that you can't really, I mean, it was scripted, but could you really script a more meta moment for Stallone to say something bad about, you know?
Right. I mean, I can almost guarantee you that Stallone wanted that line there, because that, I mean, this was the era, I think, where he was trying to shed those characters. So I think that was deliberate, and maybe.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I just had that same thought. Was like, yeah, this is him trying to like put aside like the uber macho stuff and do a more suave, sophisticated action hero. Cause that's where like things were trending in the '80s, because, you know, Rambo 3 was successful, but not as like well received as the previous one. But like, cause like Lethal Weapon and Die Hard came out, and like action heroes were getting a little bit more like grounded. And so I think that was him. I do think this was like a sincere effort for him to,
that was him handing himself the baton.
He was, yes. He's passing the torch to himself.
It's like from Rocky to Rambo, from Rambo to Tango. Tango, right? He's Tango, right?
Tango. He's, yeah. Okay,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're right. He's trying to pass the torch to himself. I love that. Yeah, but
mind if I do?
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, but like none of it works, because this doesn't do well. Oscar bomb, Stopper Mama, all those movies do not do well. And then eventually, like, he's back, you know, he does like he does Cliffhanger, which I think is a different kind of action movie too. But I think it's you know, he then gets kind of a low period after this, or maybe this is during the low period. We could debate that. But yeah, no, I think the only thing I wanted to bring up is I don't think we've talked enough about Jack Palance in this movie.
That was what I was going to bring up. I love Jack Palance. He always sounds like he can't breathe. Like, I want to just get him some air every time he talks, because it's like, and then he'll say something. It's like, oh, you need to breathe, man. And how he randomly shows up in the limo after Tango has shot the tanker, cocaine has fallen. Like, no one's looking at why is there this limo, you know, there's no traffic except for the limo that he drives by.
Yeah, here's the weird thing about that character. Tango and Cash have never heard of this guy. He's like seemingly the mastermind behind all of the major crime in L.A. Tango and Cash have never heard of him. So presumably he has been like excellent at being incognito for however long he's been in the game. But yet he decides to get very high profile. Like, he's driving by as his tanker of cocaine is being busted. He decides he's going to waltz into the prison right before Tango and Cash are about to die. It's like, dude, let him be dead. Don't, like, maybe just, you know, I know that's hubris of the villain or whatever, but like, he like shows up then. He chooses a really bad time to like up his profile.
Well, maybe he always had his profile ups and he just had never been caught.
So there's,
maybe he was always there.
So Tango and Cash just aren't as observant as we think they are.
Exactly. That's how they, I mean, know clearly. Either one of them were working on the same case.
It's like, isn't that kind of like a Sherlock thing where he realizes Moriarty was like behind everything that happened? Is that right? Wrong? Am I giving?
No, you're right. Yeah.
They've never seen Sherlock.
Spoiler. Oh, no.
No, canon. We're talking about
you can cut that. But yeah, I mean, it's just like maybe like he's just been behind everything the whole time and they just never knew. I don't know.
Yeah,
he had that supervillain kind of vibe, but it just was strange.
See, yeah. I had the city slickers currently in my head. So when I saw him, I was like, I know him, and he was not like this from what I know him from. And when I finally put it together, I think I just couldn't quite make the villain because I loved City Slickers. You know, that was a movie. It's been a while since I saw it. So, you know, you have that nostalgic sort of. Mm-hmm. I saw it when I was like 11 or 12. I think my granddaddy was watching it and really liked it. So I was like, why are you evil? You know, why are you? And everybody kind of deferred to him. I don't need to justify. Well, I just mean because I was like, it's been a while since I saw it, but you know, I loved that movie. It was great.
Yeah, I know.
But yeah, so I don't know. Maybe that's why I don't think I was scared of anyone in this movie, or like, you know, I don't think I had even the sound. None of them really put any sort of.
Well, Jack Palance also has this love of mice, which is really weird. So I think any fear that you would have had, it's just like, why are you keeping mice in a box? Yeah. Like, who just keeps mice in a box on their desk?
Like, they want him to be a Bond villain.
Right, but he doesn't have his cat.
He can't have a cat. It's like, someone thought they were really clever because, like, hey, he's going to be like a Bond villain, but instead of having a cat, he's going to have a mouse.
He's going to have two.
Right.
Get it.
He's going to have two.
And yeah.
And then he's going to put him in a maze.
After he like caresses and kisses them. Like he's like very delicate.
Very mouthy with those.
In a movie that had a lot of strange things about it, the strangest thing about it was how much it wanted to kind of be a Bond film. That is really strange. Like with the gadgets and the supervillain and then Stallone's like set up at the beginning. I don't get that. Like, I get the idea of trying to be a buddy cop and then being a little too serious, but then also throwing in these, like, weird Bond elements.
It really is, like, just, what is it, a mural of 80s action movies in, like, a tight 90-minute package.
Yeah.
It really just, because
it's a montage without the music.
Yes, exactly.
It is a montage.
Yeah, it's like a greatest hits collection. It's just in medley form. They're like, here, we're going to give you everything we can. But, you know, Palance is great. Jack Palance is one of two Oscar winners in this movie because he goes on and wins Best Supporting Actor for City Slickers. But Owen is played by Michael J. Pollard, who had won Best Supporting Actor for his role in Bonnie and Clyde back in the 60s. Like there's a lot of like, that's the other thing that I do enjoy watching about this movie now that I like know more about movies is there's a lot of great character actors in this movie that show up. Like he's in there and Brian James, we haven't even talked about Brian James and his like weird Cockney accent that he decides to have. Eddie Bunker is in here, Michael Jeter, Louis Arquette. There's like all these like, you know, really like, oh, I know him. There's a lot of familiar faces in this movie. And I think there's like a comfort factor behind that whenever you see all of those like.
So this is like our mac and cheese.
Yeah, it is. It's mac and cheese. It's, you know, you just sit and it's like, you know, there's all these like likable familiar faces doing, you know, and then in the end they, you know, They blow stuff up real good, and there's randomly monster trucks showing up.
Yeah, that huge monster truck. That was,
which is actually one of a legit monster truck. That is the famed Bigfoot monster truck that shows up in that quarry scene, the chase sequence when they're getting, like, you expect them to get chased down by equipment like bulldozers,
moving equipment,
right? All of these like bulldozers and construction, you know, vehicles. But then all of a sudden, a monster truck just shows up out of nowhere, and it's like, okay, I guess we're doing this now.
Yeah, why not add another element?
All right, so Don, I know I stole yours for Jack Palance. Was there any other scenes or moments that we missed that you stuck out to you?
We have to go back to the prison. One is the guy with the big jaw. Like his jaw just upsets me how large his jaw is. It's just unnaturally large. Mm-hmm. So I have to mention that. The other one is, why does the guy in the prison cell have a slinky? Like, that's totally
much
bad choice.
Never have seen a prison. They don't know what a prison is. Like, all the rules of the prison were just strange.
And I really don't understand why they were allowed to shower when they got there. Like,
and why were they the only... I guess if, like, you just got there, I don't know. I was trying to figure out why they were the only two people in the shower.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that scene in itself, you could probably write a bunch of, like,
and it was really long. It was a really long. I thought the same thing. I was like, based on my watching documentaries on Netflix or whatever others, you know.
Yeah. Like, this would have never happened in Orange is the New Black.
Right. They're not that concerned with how comfortable you are when you arrive.
Oh, I'm sorry. Were you a little moist from that van ride?
I mean, part. Yeah, I was like, how are they getting private escort to, you know? So, yeah, that was a very... And it was long. I was like, I thought we would learn something from, because they were in there for a while. I didn't really get anything new from that.
No, all that is Stallone being like, okay, well, wait a minute. I'm playing this like sophisticated guy. So I'm in suits all the time. How are people going to know how ripped I got for this movie? That is all that is. That is like, oh, well, I guess I got to do, we'll do it. Well, we're doing prison. I guess we'll do a shower scene and I can shit, you know, cause he's, yeah. That's the one problem with being like a super suave guy is there's very little opportunities for him to be shirtless.
And it's that he's constantly torn between the need to be shirtless and his desire to be taken more seriously.
Right. That is that's the eternal struggle behind Stallone.
I hope not anymore.
I need people to know that I'm it still is. He just did a new Rambo where he's like the gritty Rambo, but he's still like a beast. I'm serious, but I'm also, you know, I'm still ripped. And I forgot the other character actor, because I'm glad you mentioned Slinky, because Clint Howard plays the guy, they call him Slinky, the Tango's cellmate in his prison. So another fine character actor that shows up. So a couple of other facts about this movie we mentioned earlier. Yeah, this was a very troubled production, starting with Stallone's intended co-star for this movie was not Kurt Russell at the beginning.
Say what?
No, it was originally supposed to be Patrick Swayze. He drops out of the movie to do another classic 1989
action. Oh, please say it was Dirty
Dancing. No. Oh, this is poster. This is, so he drops out so he can do Roadhouse. So where he gets to kick all the ass by himself.
Okay, yeah,
you know, he's like, I could be in a buddy movie or I could do his own. But so Patrick Swayze drops out to do Roadhouse. And Kurt Russell steps in. The ironic part about that is that Kurt Russell originally turned down the role of Riggs in Lethal Weapon.
Oh, that sucks.
Yeah, so he ends up doing like kind of this
the staff version the
great value version of Lethal Weapon of Riggs. Yeah, complete with the feathered hair. Like he literally looks like he could be Mel Gibson.
Yeah,
from Lethal Weapon.
Did have the hair in Overboard, so
he did.
It's
a staple
of him. I mean, he still has it in the Christmas Chronicles. So
that's true. Yeah.
That's his hair.
No, you're right.
Mel Gibson stole his hair.
Yes, I'll co-sign that. So Patrick Swayze drops out. They started shooting this movie before they had finished the script. So Stallone had to take over some of the writing of this movie, which makes a ton of sense. He's not the only person that gets brought in though. And this will also make sense because another person that gets brought in to help finish the script is Jeffrey Boehm, who worked on the scripts of the first two Lethal Weapon films.
Oh.
So you've got the producer of Lethal Weapon. You've got the director of Lethal. You've got the writer, one of the writers for Lethal Weapon. You have the editor for Lethal Weapon. So that's like, again, why this movie, if this movie feels like a knockoff, it's because like all of these people are just playing the hits, basically. Yeah. And even John Peters had worked on Die Hard. So they make the same... And they make the same Stevie Wonder driving joke as they do in Die Hard.
What?
Because remember when he asks Kurt Russell, where'd you learn to drive like this? Yeah. Stevie Wonder. Bruce Willis has a line when he's watching Reginald Vell Johnson drive around. He goes, who's driving his car? Stevie Wonder? literally a recycled joke now. So they're making this movie. The film goes over budget. They fire one director. A couple of other directors take over in the process. And ultimately, this movie gets finished a week before its debut. Oh. It is shipped. It is literally shipped to theaters like hot off the presses. So after the final edit, the original edit of this movie is about 20 minutes longer. So there's a lot of stuff that gets left on the cutting room floor, which is why if you watch the trailer, there's a lot of deleted scenes. So
yeah, the trailer is mostly stuff that you don't see.
Right. Exactly. So they the fact that this movie is completed and is as coherent as it is kind of a minor miracle anyway.
What year did they start filming it?
I believe I think they started in 1989.
Oh, okay. And that was a lot of turnover in a short amount of time.
Correct. Yeah. So, and there's all these little in jokes in there. There's the line that Stallone has about Rambo, but there's also a line where Tango asks if they want to go get coffee in a Danish, or Cash says that. And then Stallone says, "I hate Danish." So he had just recently divorced Brigitte Nielsen, who is Danish.
I thought that joke,
that was another odd one.
Yeah, it just kind of didn't feel like that's strange. Okay.
As he does a deep burn to the camera.
Yeah. Exactly. So yeah, the movie comes out. It's not, and that to me, this is a weird movie to be released on Christmas weekend. Yeah. So it doesn't do like
it seems like it should be a summer blockbuster.
Yeah, it absolutely should be. Like I think if they had just waited and maybe made this as spring of 1990 or whatever, tried to get it out, they could have maybe it would have made more money because I think
were the hits in 19?
Well, by 1990, that's the summer of Die Hard 2 and Dick Tracy. 90's not a but if it had come out the summer of 89, it had gotten slaughtered by Batman and Lethal Weapon 2 and Indiana Jones. That's a banner year. But anyway, so yeah, this movie ends up kind of getting more of a cult following on through cable to the point where there has been discussion about a sequel. So back in September, Sylvester Stallone said he has the idea for a story.
I can help him write it.
Yeah. You have it.
I have a lot of details.
Stallone, if you're listening, give us a call. Donna has some thoughts that he reportedly has reached out to Kurt Russell about doing it. He reports that Kurt Russell is hesitant to do it, but he didn't say no. So here's my thought. We just got the news that Netflix is going to produce Beverly Hills Cop 4. They're working with Paramount on that. Netflix, get on the ball. If we're going to start recycling or if we're going to reboot some 80s IP, we could get a Tango and Cash sequel, right?
Here's the thing. If that happens, I want it full on. I want it written and directed by Stallone. 100%. I want it all in.
Yeah.
If he says he's got a story idea, then don't do this thing where you kind of write it and then get someone else to direct it. Nope. I want your vision. I want the pure Stallone vision of what this Tango and Cash. I mean, I say that jokingly. I legitimately do think I like Stallone as a I think when I talk about me being a fan, I watch a lot of things he directed or had a hand in writing. And some of them aren't great, but I think that he does better in some ways when he doesn't just hand off his half vision to somebody else. Cause I think that's where there's a lot of disconnect. Mm-hmm. He does bad sometimes when it's just him too, but sure. I think it's at least more interesting when he does it. So I want to see him do this.
Yeah. Oh, 100%. Netflix, get on it. You're going to make eight Christmas movies a year. You've made three Christmas Prince movies. You can't give me a Tango and Cash 2. Yeah. We could do that. And Kurt Russell's game, he already did, he's already done some Netflix stuff. He already did Christmas Chronicles. So just, pony up the dough. I will say that was my biggest disappointment with Guardians of the Galaxy 2, because you had Kurt Russell and Sylvester Stallone in the same movie, and you don't put them on screen together just for a shot. You don't figure out a way to get Tango and Cash on screen together.
Yeah.
That's why Scorsese doesn't think you're cinema.
Yeah, exactly what he's referring to.
It is that moment. That's the moment he was out on the MCU, because he's a little known fact, Scorsese, big Tango and Cash fan.
I bet.
an auteur would have known to put those two in a scene together.
And Stallone reportedly tried to get Kurt Russell on board for the Expendables franchise, but ultimately Russell declined the role, and that ended up going to Bruce Willis. So Stallone like really wants to work with Kurt Russell again. And yeah, I get the feeling like Kurt Russell's just like, nah, I'm good.
Oh, is he ghosting him?
Oh, I hope not.
I hope not.
Yeah.
This bromance to continue.
I think that Kurt Russell probably like thought that that movie was just a bad dream that they had. He had, and he was like, hey, I had a weird dream the other night where like you and I were like, we got framed, we were cops, like we took a shower together. It was really kind of all very weird. And Stallone was like, no, you mean Tango and Cash? It comes out next week.
Yeah, I'd agree. The 80s were wild, man. Exactly. Goldie, what did you let me do? I wake up one morning, I'm in a movie with Stallone. What is this? All right. Okay, so let's take this to our guilt meter on Guilty Pleasures here. On a scale of 1 to 5 shame spirals, 1 being you love this movie, you think everybody should see this movie, you're first on board for Tango and Cash 2, all the way to 5, meaning you either didn't like this movie, or if you like this movie, you couldn't in good conscience recommend it to anybody, you'll just watch it by yourself. Where does Tango and Cash fall on the guilt meter? Donna, I'm going to start with you because I think this is the easiest one.
This is going to be the highest I think I have ever rated one of the shows. I'm thinking like a 1.5.
Okay.
Because I really can't like fully support all of it.
Okay.
But I really love it. So 1.5. High marks.
All right. Nick, how about you?
I might go with, I'm trying to think. Probably I enjoyed watching. I'm going to go with 2. I'm going to go with a 2, which is like, I think that I would be fine recommending it. But at the same time, like I wouldn't, like, actually, I started talking about Mallrats. Like, Mallrats is a movie a lot of people don't like, but I would say I love it. Like, watch it. Everyone should watch it, right? This is a movie I'm like, I don't love it, but I actually think, you know, I wouldn't be embarrassed recommending it. I mean, you should check it out. It's worth seeing. There's a lot in here to unpack.
Yeah, there is.
Did you miss the 80s? Watch Tango and Cash.
Yeah. Why watch all these action 80s movies when you can get it all in one film?
That's right.
All right.
Take your booster shot.
All right, Katrina, how about you?
I would say I'm probably hovering about 2, 2.5. Like you said, I would recommend it, but I'd also be like, you know, there may be some things you don't love, maybe some lines that you put your back up a little, you know, so just know that that is possible. So I don't think I could not let people know, sort of like, you know, be prepare yourself in some ways. I just think it's a barrel of a lot, you know, and unpacking is the right way to put it. I think there's a lot to unpack. But yeah, I would say probably like a 2.5 because I'm not ashamed that I've seen it. I wouldn't be ashamed to be like, hey, you should check out Tango and Cash. But I would, like you said, maybe put a little like, just so you know, there may be some lines in there that, you know, so mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I'm with you, Donna. I'm going to do 1.5 as well. I mean, in my heart, it's a 1, but I know there's people that I, the more I talk about these movies, the more I'm thinking of like, okay, who would I recommend this to? And I think there's probably some people that maybe I wouldn't recommend this to, but I'm like, okay, first of all, if anybody wants to see what 80s action movies were like, you 100% should see this movie. If anybody like wants to see like peak hubris Stallone, it's great for that. If you like Kurt Russell, it's great for that. And like, it is just it's a really breezy action movie. And I think that's a lost art form today because so many action movies are like really long. They're like 2 hours plus. This movie clocks in. It's a lean 98 minutes. And it, like, you've heard us talk. All of that takes place in 90 minutes.
So we've actually now talked longer than the movie.
I think we have. Yeah. I think, but that's how dense this movie is. It's like, you know, it's, but so yeah, I, but it's so, we watched it the other night and it's just, it, is so much fun to sit through. And so I would sit through this again.
I was nervous for them. I admit it still got me like nervous. Are they going to make it out? Like that's a lot of fire.
It was. So yeah, no, this is a 1.5 for me. This is like a definite recommend. I think you need to check this out. It's a great artifact of a kind of a bygone era, I think. And it's just still, I think it holds up pretty well. There's obviously some stuff where you roll your eyes like, yeah, okay, we wouldn't do that anymore. But, every 80s movie has that to an extent. So check it out if you get a chance. I think it's a lot of fun. I want to thank you guys for coming on. This was so much fun. I love that we finally got to talk Tango and Cash and get you both on the podcast. So I appreciate it. If you want to, do either of you have any projects coming up you want people to know about or any social media you want to plug? Nick, how about you?
No, I don't really have anything to plug.
Okay. All right. Katrina, how about you?
No, okay. I got nothing.
All right. Donna, how about you? You still active on Twitter?
I'm just here for the warm fuzzies of Tango and Cash.
Okay. All right. All right. Well, but you can follow me on Twitter at the fake Lou Hare. You can follow me on Instagram at Lou Hare, and you can follow the Front Row Network at Front Row Reviews with a Z on Twitter, or you can find us on Facebook. We have a lot of stuff. Guilty Pleasures is not slowing down. I've got a lot on my plate for December, and I'm excited about all of it, because two things are happening. First of all, it's Christmas time, so we've got bonkers Christmas movies coming out our ears. So we're going to do a Netflix Christmas movie, The Night Before Christmas. That's KNIGHT.
Oh boy.
Before Christmas. Vanessa Hudgens, time travel, Christmas. What more do you people need? I'm very excited to discuss that. But there's a movie coming out on December 20th. That I'm very excited about. While you are all going to see Star Wars Episode 9, I will be first in line for Cats. And I cannot wait for this. I am going to see this. And we will definitely do a podcast. We will do a full disclosure / guilty pleasures talking all about Cats. It's Merry Christmas to me and to everyone for that. I'm so excited for that. So definitely to get all of that content, make sure you are subscribed to the Guilty Pleasures feed on iTunes or Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts. And if you go to iTunes and you rate and review us, give us a 5-star review. If in that review you request a movie, we'll do it. We'll put it on the list. 2020 is wide open. We got lots of stuff. We'll do anything that you want us to do. So please make sure you check us out there. You can also find us on NPR Illinois as part of our community voices and our own website, frnpod.com. I think that's everything for now. Thank you all for joining us. Thank you, Nick and Katrina, for joining us. Thank you, Donna, for coming back. Can I pencil you in for Cats?
I don't know. I might have a hairball at that time.
All right. Well, in the meantime, thank you all. Have a good evening. And for the Front Row Network, I'm...